I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we will talk about alternative energy. As the fossil fuels that have provided much of our energy become more difficult to find and therefore expensive, the need to find other sources of energy becomes more and more acute. How are we doing in regard to meeting that need? We will try to answer that question with our guests, Patrick Flynn of the Indiana Office of Energy Development, Chris Cowger of EnerOne Indianapolis, and Jim Lowe of Ball State University, and, of course, you. We will be delighted to take your calls toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, your emails at nolimits@wfyi.org, and your comments or questions via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. Please do join the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are here today. We're talking about alternative energy, and we are fortunate to have as our guests Patrick Flynn of the Indiana Office of Energy Development. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate being here.
Good to have you here. Chris Cowger, president of EnerOne Indianapolis. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Good, John.
Good to have you here. And Jim Lowe, who is head of Ball State University's geothermal project. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Great day to be inside.
Fabulous day to be inside. We also would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, we're going to start here at sort of a basic building block level here with this discussion of alternative energy. Can we talk a little bit about what alternative energy is or what the what sources of alternative energy there are? I'll start with you, Patrick.
I think it's pretty diverse. I don't think that our office really focuses on one source or one place to start. Right now, in fact, in Indianapolis, we have our Windiana Conference where people from around the state and as well as outside the state have all come together to discuss what is alternative energy and how best to utilize that in Indiana. And I think it's everything from wind to solar to biomass, you know, to geothermal, as well as alternative fuel vehicles. I mean, I think that's something that's less represented, but also I think that it includes things like efficiency projects. You know, not only do we want to find new sources of energy, but use the energy that we have right now better
and more effectively.
And that's a lot of work that our office has been doing in the last couple of years.
Chris Cowger, could you take a stab at defining alternative energy?
Yeah, I think at the highest level, you take the definition and say, hey, it's anything that isn't fossil fuel related. But, I agree that it goes a little bit broader than that. And I think particularly in the context of EnerOne, which is a lithium ion energy storage solutions company, you know, we take the broader view of it's really about this energy storage and efficiency aspect. And a lot of that energy that we're storing, of course, was originally fossil fuel based, right? Whether it was coal fired, whether it was, oil, gas fired, ultimately it was fossil fuel related. But the ability to use that energy much more efficiently over time is a key part of the equation as well. So I think you can define it very, very broadly, or you can define it narrowly into any one of these aspects.
Jim Lowe, I'll give you the last stab at this question, and then we'll...
Well, I'd replace the word alternative with perhaps sustainable.
Okay.
Any type of opportunity that would allow us to sustain that particular type of energy source for years to come, such as what we're doing with the geothermal project and utilizing the ground's ability to provide energy or store energy when it's needed for heating and cooling.
Could you talk a little bit about the geothermal project, what it is, what you're trying to do there?
What geothermal for Ball State, for our system and our use, is not drilling down and capturing hot water deep down miles into the earth. It's really using the ground's ability to provide for an energy source or to allow a place to deposit energy, for that matter, during the summer. The ground normally maintains 55 degrees in this area. And so geothermal, in our case, is drilling into the ground, installing heat exchangers, a tube that will flow water down into the ground, in our case, 400 feet and back up, that will allow the thermodynamic property to occur where energy will either flow into the ground or back into that water system. And we'll use that source to simultaneously make both hot water and chilled water that will provide the heating and cooling needs for our campus, which will replace or allow us to shut down our coal-fired boilers that make steam currently. So we'll make hot water and chilled water at the same time.
How far away are you from being able to do that?
We are just months away from starting up the first portion of the system, which will provide heating and cooling for nearly half the campus. And we're moving into a portion of the second, perhaps, phase of the project that at this point in time could be completed within the next couple of years.
So are you saying then that within a couple of years or 5 years, Ball State University, the entire campus, would not be relying on fossil fuels? Or
that is correct. Our goal at this point in time is within the next couple of years, we would be in the position where we would burn no fossil fuel. Therefore, we would be totally heating and cooling the campus with a geothermal-based system, and therefore actually reduce nearly in half our carbon footprint.
Well, let me ask you real quickly, and I'm fascinated by what's going on at Ball State University, but I'd like to take this into a broader context. And I think the perception out there is that we get, as a society, culture, whatever, we get very, very interested in discovering and utilizing alternative, or to use Jim's word, sustainable sources of energy when gas prices spike. And then when the fuel prices begin to fall back, our interest level dissipates. Are we making progress on this front? I'll go to Patrick Flynn on that.
Absolutely. I think that we've made a lot of progress, and I think part of that, too, is that you have to think about the cost of the project and putting the right types of alternatives, if you want to use that word, into place. You can't just say, you know, put up a solar panel because today your electricity bill is going to be really high, when it may not make financial sense for you. But as the cost of those types of systems become less and less, and our ability to put them into effect become greater, the cost goes down, and it becomes a lot more cost competitive with the fossil fuels that have sort of had a 100-year head start, so to speak, in terms of being used and being viable in our society. And I think that our office views it as not just one solution to the problem, but trying to figure out which of these individual solutions work best for what you're trying to do, whether that's a geothermal system, whether that's solar or wind or, you know, efficiency projects, trying to find which best fits into what you're doing.
How does your office work? I mean, what services do you provide?
We were founded in 2005 by the governor as the designated energy office for the state of Indiana. A lot of what we do is grant program management. A lot of that comes from federal dollars that we readminister throughout the state in a variety of programs, which include everything from efficiency to renewables to alternative fuels. We also handle outreach and education events, as well as the working groups, which include a biomass working group, a wind working group, and a solar working group, where our intent is to bring together people within all of those industries to come together in a collaborative way to figure out how best we can promote those types of technologies within the state.
Chris Cowger, are we making progress on the alternative or sustainable energy front?
I think we are. I think there's really two parts to the formula, I think, at the end of the day. And one is certainly these government incentive programs, loans, grants that really kind of help a lot of these alternative energy companies and institutions get off the ground and get some momentum going. But I think here we've also captured the absolutely necessary other piece of that. It is ultimately long-term, this has to be economically viable and self-sustaining. You know, ultimately, you can't enter one's a publicly traded company and I can't get on an earnings call and talk about my my grants and everything else and expect shareholders to care. You know, what they want to know is that ultimately we're able to put together economic viability and positive return on investment programs for customers that show the technology we give them and the energy efficiency that that affords ultimately pays itself back and then some. But, you know, I do think you need both before you get to that kind of mass and scale and broad public adoption. A lot of companies and institutions in this space do need that little kickstart. But that kickstart is there, and it definitely seems to be more and more consistent and I think more broadly recognized throughout the market.
Who are your customers and what services or technology do you provide for them? What sorts of different sources?
Yeah, we're essentially in overall, like I said earlier, we're in what we call the lithium ion energy storage solution business, which, you know, people think very on a very simplistic term. Most folks have a lithium ion battery, say, in their laptop, like you have right over there. Essentially, we're using more or less the same chemistries. We'd use what's called a large format prismatic cell, as opposed to what you have in there is more of a smaller cylindrical cell. But whether you're talking big scale, small scale, they all do the same thing. And so within that, though, we kind of have three core businesses that we focus on. The first, which I think is probably what we're best known for, at least what most of the press is about around us, and that's transportation. So that can be anything from light duty, where we work with partners like Volvo, where we have a fully electrified Volvo C30 product that they sell in Europe that we provide the complete battery solution for. So that'd be a light duty application. Medium and heavy duty, where you're probably working more on hybrid electric type systems for medium heavy duty trucks and buses. So Hyundai Heavy Industries, for example, in Korea is one of our heavy duty bus customers. And then the next business, then we have grid energy storage, where I think probably our biggest, most prolific customers, the Federal Grid Company of Russia, where we actually provide kind of a turnkey, uninterruptible power storage solution for them. So basically, if a substation goes out in St. Petersburg, Sochi, et cetera, we're able to deliver a megawatt hour of storage back into the grid. And then our final business is one that's probably more what folks are used to, and that's small pack. So think handheld devices, anything portable, but not so much focus on consumer electronics. We focus more on mission-critical military and medical applications.
Well, let me ask real quickly, that when you talk about a lithium-ion battery, could you explain and pretend I am a first grader here, why that is more efficient or sustainable than, say, fossil fuels would be, traditional fossil fuels?
Well, I think it's if you look at the longevity of the product, would definitely be one. I think take the grid energy storage example. I think it's kind of been well documented and well known how much of our overall energy problem at a grid level is with transmission loss, right? I think couple that with why we struggle with other means of alternative energy, say wind, say solar, where you have the issue around people don't always need power when the wind is blowing, and people don't always need power when the sun is shining. And if you're not using it when those generation activities are happening, the energy is largely lost on top of the transmission issues with it. Where lithium ion can kind of come in as a key technology here is you're able to capture all the energy generated at the point of generation and pretty much use it as demand dictates.
Okay, so that
it's effectively a buffer for where the sources and uses of energy.
We are talking about alternative, or with the slight nudge from Jim Lowe of Ball State University, sustainable energy here on No Limits. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We are talking with Jim Lowe, head of Ball State University's Geothermal Project, Chris Cowger, president of NR1 Indianapolis, Patrick Flynn, the Indiana Office of Energy Development. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about alternative or sustainable energy with our guest, Patrick Flynn of the Indiana Office of Energy Development, Chris Cowger, president of NR1 Indianapolis, and Jim Lowe, head of Ball State University's Geothermal Project. And I would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I apologize, I got diverted there. We are talking about alternative energy. Jesse, how are you doing?
Good, John. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you here. And I understand you want to talk about diversification of energy?
Right, John. So this is Jesse Carbonda, the director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And, yeah, I mean, we applaud all the work that Patrick and Chris and Jim are doing, and I've gotten to know a couple of them firsthand. I think, though, that there needs to be a bigger conversation in our community about the need to accelerate diversification from coal. It's certainly been, you know, the mainstay of power for Indiana for many decades, but those costs are increasing in a systematic way. You know, the price of coal has gone up 67% between 2009 and 2010, and then you've got extremely, stringent lending criteria by banks regarding coal financing. So I think we've just got to push from renewables and efficiency, and we can do that in a way that wouldn't compromise grid reliability and costs.
Well, Patrick, would you like to respond?
Yeah, absolutely. I've met Jesse and had some several conversations with him regarding these types of issues, and I think that's the goal of the Energy Office, and the goal of everyone here who's working on it is trying to figure out how best to put your resource dollars and to put your time and energy into ways to make it a seamless transition and not have to rely on technologies that may or may not work when you need them. I think the point was brought up, wind does tend to blow at night, and that's typically when the least amount of power is needed. And how do you create maybe an energy storage system or something that would allow you to use that power when you need it? The sun, if it's not shining like you need to, is, you know, the technology that we currently have gets better and better, we'll be able to capture more of that energy. But again, if you're capturing it when you to set off peak, how much more of that energy do you need? And I think that's, you know, with education, the consumers will be able to want those types of technologies more. And I think our office, though, you don't want to promote things that are not cost effective. And that's really the issue. As the cost of those comes down and coal goes up, I think you're very quickly going to want to come into more renewable energies that will allow us to become more sustainable and not rely on coal so much. But yeah, we get, I think, around 95% of our electricity comes from coal. It's pretty cheap here in the Midwest, and as that goes up, we'll start to look at things that states in the West and East have been doing for a long time. It's just that we're slower to come to it because it's been pretty cheap electricity.
Let's talk about a little bit, I think, sort of the jump-off point for Jesse's question really was what we could do as a government to promote this transition to alternative or sustainable energy. And I think I'll throw that back to Chris Cowger. Are there things that you think the state or the federal government could do that would help people make the transition a little more easily?
Yeah, so I'll answer that in two parts. First, okay. I want to say at both a state and a national level, I first want to start by acknowledging that I think a lot is already being done. But I think the majority of what I see being done at this point right now is really more focused on, the corporations and institutions that are trying to drive this evolution forward. And what we seem to be missing, again, to try and to hit what I was talking about earlier, the all-important economic formula mm-hmm. where we can all kind of proceed forward in this direction and people can actually make money doing so, is finding the right set of incentives to make it compelling for the consumer. I think that's still the one piece, we're missing. It's very clear if you're, running a company and you're in a position like the one I am, it's state and federal government makes it very clear and very compelling with grants, loans, et cetera, why you want to be in this space and how they can help drive you forward. But that still leaves us stuck with a consumer who at some point is still bearing a bit of an economic burden to make the leap. And we have to find the right formula for that. And I think, there's numerous examples, particularly Europe and China, where they're doing a very, very fantastic job with that right now.
Better than we are?
I think a lot better than we are.
Yes, and oversimplified, perhaps, and I probably should do a disclosure here, that my brother-in-law is in the solar energy business, and at least, and I understand just enough of what he does to be dangerous. So there is a possibility I will mischaracterize this. But as he says, much of the salesmanship evolves around this question that we're talking about right now, that the initial barriers, the front-end barriers to going solar, to doing something like this, are significant to someone, who's trying to figure out if this will cost out perhaps in their lifetimes, and that's really where the effort should be focused and on helping to make that transition. I think Patrick alluded to helping, at least at the front end, the early consumers not have to bear all of the R&D costs that went into all of this. Is that a fair assessment, Patrick?
I think it's a fairly fair assessment. I think part of it, too, something like solar, as an example, gets a bad rap because when it came out 10, 15, 20-plus years ago, the efficiency wasn't good enough to really make people really want to jump on it, and it was so expensive that now everyone has this idea in their head, I think, or some, not everybody, but some people, that it's just too expensive, I can't do it. But again, as technology gets better, prices come down, that's not going to happen as much. But also think about a homeowner who maybe only wants to live in their house for 5 or 10 years, and the payback on this might be greater than that. Well, are they going to get that back at resale, or how do they recoup their costs of putting in a fairly expensive system and burden to them? And there's other things like their insurances or something else with having this solar system on top of their house that they have to bear, and they have to be willing to want to do that. And some people are, and some people get into it knowing what all the risks are and the costs are. But I think as the education and more that we see the promotion of these types of systems, I think they'll only get less expensive and easier for people. And, as home builders want to put them in more readily, I think it's just going to get better and better for consumers, and they won't have to bear that cost.
And I think we've got a large sort of scale object lesson here with the geothermal project at Ball State University. I mean, how much did that, Jim Lowe, how much did that project cost? Was there resistance on the part of Ball State University, or at least reluctance to assume that cost, the front end, and when do they assume that they'll recoup those costs? How long a period will it be to do that, or did they even look at it in that fashion?
We did. Understanding as a premise to all this is we're all faced with aged systems. In our case, we have 70-year-old coal boilers that aren't the cleanest technology around for even burning coal. And we were moving forward to replace those coal boilers. There certainly was a big expense in doing that. And when that number came through, we started studying other options, other sustainable options, and turned to geothermal as a comparison. And although there is an incremental upcharge to geothermal, there is a tremendous payback. And our particular situation, we will save nearly $2 million a year in operating costs when our system's up and running in total. But it certainly is a large capital cost, as it is with any residential type setting. Understand a homeowner certainly would look at that, and as Pat has pointed out, think about the fact that I may only be in my home for a few short years, and why would I want to install a system such as that? But back to the government and the state, there are incentives now that are in place that provide, I believe, a 30% reduction in the cost of a geothermal system for our home. And I believe in the state of Indiana, it also is eligible to take off your assessed value, so it reduces your property taxes. So those are incentives that are being placed on homeowners to move forward with those type of sustainable efforts. In our case, we are wanting to use our project as the stepping stone to determine more efficient ways, or cheaper ways, I should say, in installing geothermal systems so that we can share that lessons learned with the nation. And anybody that are considering a system such as ours in this large size, and with that maybe a little more incentive in spending what might be a large capital amount of money up front for a project that will last forever.
And how large roughly is the investment up front?
Our particular project, with all the components that are required to install a new distribution system on campus, because we're steam-based, we have to install a hot water distribution system. We have to buy heat pump chillers that actually produce the hot and cold water simultaneously. The biggest cost of a geothermal system is drilling the boreholes. We're drilling 3,600 boreholes, which equates to about 10,000 tons of operating capacity. And then we have to go into our buildings, which are in some cases steam-based, and we have to convert them to hot water. And when you add that together, we're going to have a capital outlay of nearly $80 million. I caution folks to look at it as an $80 million compared to no cost at all, because, again, back we were faced with the need to replace our old coal boilers. We had to do something because of boiler MAC, because of condition, because of capacity. And so it's the incremental difference between those two options, one which is not a sustainable effort and one that is.
So to clarify real quickly, what you were saying is they're going to have to do a capital investment anyway.
Anyway.
The question is one kind or the other. And over time, this will be $2 million per year cheaper. We're talking about alternative or sustainable energy. And I would invite our listeners to call us at 1-866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Travis, how are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. Thank you for joining the program. I understand you got a question about mass transit.
Yeah. There's just so much stuff on the market right now for my home, so I have to instead ask you a question what the panel might have to add to the topic of mass transit, because it's as the central Indiana slowly gets behind this, it, by the time they finally do something, it's just embarrassing that they're...
Oops. It sounded like we were getting some feedback. I think what Chris, probably you're the best one to start here. If I understand where the question was going, he was going to ask about the lithium-ion technology for mass transit and whether that would be a viable option.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. And I'll give you a couple examples of applications. One customer name I can quote to you and one I can't. But one application is, again, medium and heavy-duty buses. One of the big projects we have going on, particularly in Asia, is around electrification of transit buses, particularly in Japan and Korea are strong markets for us, where, they're large packs. They're rather expensive in the grand scheme of things, but when you look at the fossil fuel costs of a transit business like this, the return on investment and a non-government incented real payback is very clear and very real for them. So from that aspect, that application the technology works and the economics work, which again gets back to my earlier point of, I think at the end of the day, people have to be able to make money to really make this shift take hold. But also when you talk about mass transit, you might be talking about commuter rail mm-hmm. or other applications like that. And that's another one where we're working with a couple customers, one in Canada and one in Europe, where they're already electrified commuter trains, but this one customer is particularly interesting. They're trying to beautify the city by taking the overhead wiring down. So basically what they need is their electric trains, which are already electric, to be able to jump the grid at various points in the city, which means then they have to go over to a lithium-ion backup power. So what's interesting is...
Well, it's interesting in that there's an aesthetic component to this, too, rather than simply a functionality question.
Right, right. I mean, we see that with a lot of customers where, you know, we start interacting with them thinking from our perspective that this is about fossil fuel cost avoidance, energy efficiency, carbon footprint reduction, et cetera, and with many customers, we find out that it ends up being something totally different. I'll quote another very good customer of ours, and that's Toro. We make a lithium ion powered high-end greens mower, where ultimately we're thinking, okay, they're looking to reduce their fuel cost as in the golf industry. And it turns out what they were looking to do is be able to mow the greens at night, because fossil fuel burning greens mowers are rather loud. And as everyone kind of knows, most 18-hole golf courses tend to be surrounded by fairly nice homes where people don't like to be awakened by lawnmowers in the middle of the night.
At 2 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly. The solution that we're able to put together for them runs totally silent. And they're actually, for the golf courses that have adopted this, they run at night, and they're able to get a fantastically quick return on investment by the amount of incremental playing time they're able to have during the day. They can open the course sooner because the greens have already been mowed at night, and they can keep them open later because the greens will be mowed the following night. So it's one of these things where it started under the auspice of energy efficiency, but the real economic value ended up being something very, very different.
Well, and it's a time management and allocation. I want to continue Travis's line of questioning, though, because something you said really intrigued me when we talked about this. I mean, would it be possible to take, you know, Indianapolis's current bus system and provide a lithium ion solution for that or alternative to that? And what would the cost be for doing something like that? I know we're not going to assume this is an RFP, but you got to be precise.
Like
that, and
you want to get some contract paperwork out there. Let's get started.
Okay.
So let me take the two questions. The second one might be a little bit more difficult to answer because every application is different. But, you know, is it possible to do here? Absolutely, it's possible to do here. I mean, if you look at kind of who are the major OEM manufacturers of these buses, there's only a handful of them around the world, and they're all utilizing kind of very similar chassis designs and engine designs, etc. So in so much as we're able to do it now for customers in Europe and Asia, we can absolutely do it right here at home as well. In terms of the cost, you know, it totally depends on the size of the solution and how much energy storage you need to make it work. But you know, you're kind of, I'll give you a very rough ballpark in case I have any competitors listening right now who are going to sniff out my pricing, but just say per bus anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 a bus is probably what it costs.
And how much would that's with an existing, or would you be building the bus from the ground up?
That, 9 times out of 10, that's a retrofit of an existing design.
Okay, in fact, so it's on top of the cost of buying the bus already.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things, how we work best with most customers is, you know, not kind of design around the battery, you know, to keep the downside upfront economic impact minimized to the customer. We kind of say, give us the energy storage requirement and give us the geometry and the weight that we have to work with, and we'll put together a solution for you. So, you know, which I think gets to another theme here, and that is a lot of this, I think there's a huge onus on private industry to get creative on how to make this work, not only in terms of the designs and the solutions, but creative on an economic model as well that works.
We are talking about alternative or sustainable energy here on No Limits, and our guests are Chris Cowger of President of EnerOne Indianapolis, Patrick Flynn of the Indiana Office of Energy Development, Jim Lowe, head of Ball State University's Geothermal Project. We also would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about alternative or sustainable energy with our guest, Chris Cowger of EnerOne Indianapolis, Patrick Flynn with the Indiana Office of Energy Development, and Jim Lowe, who is head of Ball State University's Geothermal Project. We were talking right before the break about public transportation, whether responding to a listener's question about whether it would be possible to do mass transit with that model here. And we managed to pin Chris down and give us a few numbers here on what that might cost. I'd like to ask Patrick, is that, you know, in terms of a public policy perspective, does that make sense?
Oh, it absolutely makes sense. And I think there's not only with electric vehicles, but there's several technologies out there that do work that include natural gas and propane, which are a domestic product that are more, you know, cleaner burning that you can get here right here in the state. So it does lessen our burden on, you know, on foreign oil. There are organizations that do this all the time. And the Clean Cities Program, I encourage all listeners to go, you know, check them out. There are two organizations here in the state that can help communities with these types of projects, and I've seen them retrofit buses, and I've seen the electric buses, and they do exist. I think a lot of people in central Indiana are sort of, you know, that want this mass transit, think of trains immediately in a mass transit subway system or something of that nature, but it could start very easily and I think a lot more readily with sustainable buses and things like that.
Bill, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, certainly. Thank you for joining us. What's your question?
Well, my question, and it's interesting that Patrick alludes to the fact that this sort of technology is good public policy. My question is, if in fact it is good public policy, why hasn't the state of Indiana, with its own vehicle fleet, done more to diversify into alternative and cleaner energy? Because it's basically a fossil fuel fleet and a flex fuel fleet, and with the dearth of infrastructure for ethanol south of I-70 in the state of Indiana, the state's government fleet is effectively a fossil fuel fleet. So why isn't the state doing a better job of diversifying if in fact cleaner burning fuels, alternative fuels, is good public policy?
Thank you for the question.
Well, okay. I do think the fleet, I've been with the Energy Office for about a year and a half, and I can't give all the historic numbers and where they've been, but I do know that you know, the fuel that the car that I drive for the state when I go around is, I typically take one too. I take an all electric vehicle, the Think car, which Enerdell has batteries in, and it is a flex fuel. But on top of that, I can tell you that NDOT in particular has really gone to alternative fuels. So they just actually installed 115 propane stations throughout the state at all of their facilities and retrofitted. They began with just over 200 retrofits to propane, that actually all of those retrofits were done here in Union City at PCI, which is now IMCO. So kind of an all-inclusive Indiana project. And they've actually gone beyond that and retrofitted Ford Rangers and other vehicles within their fleet to run on propane rather than conventional gasoline. And they've also purchased CNG dump trucks. So it's becoming along, but it is one of those things where it's, I think, like with Jim's geothermal project, when you have to replace and you have to start thinking of ways to save money, you really start to implement these types of projects. And part of that was helped with a competitive grant that they won through through a grant that I actually am helping administer through our office. And they've been able to take that and run with it and really be able to, I think, in effect, jumpstart what hopefully they would have done on their own, but now they're just getting a few years ahead of the game.
Is there resistance here in the state to doing? I mean, it has been a coal state for a long time. So
I think there's resistance with anything change, especially with these vehicles. There's an educational component to people having to learn, how to fuel them. What do you look for? How, even things as simple as starting the engine is a little bit different. I think people are hesitant just in the fact that they don't know a lot about it, but once you educate them and run them through some training classes, and they have to know that, hey, I can go this far on this fuel with this tank and know that they're not going to run out of fuel in the middle of somewhere. And I think we'll run into that more with the electric vehicles. They call it range anxiety, of knowing how far can I go and can I get back to where I started.
Yeah, I struggle. I just bought a hybrid not long ago, and I struggle with the idea that I really don't need to put a key in the ignition still. So, Chris Cowger.
Yeah, I think Pat touches on a really important point. Actually, two important points there. If you want to take the broader alternative fuel and focus more on electrification of transportation, and one the caller also touched on as well, and that is infrastructure is absolutely key to making this happen. I mean, one of the biggest roadblocks, I think, overall, for assuming we figure out the economic formula I've talked about to make it compelling or even advantageous to consumers, is you have to have charging infrastructure everywhere you go, because it does then parlay into the next thing that Pat talked about, range anxiety. So I too frequently drive a Think car around Indianapolis, and when the charge is at 10% and you're on 465 with an 18-wheeler bearing down on you, that's a religious experience. And something people aren't used to, but old habits definitely die hard, but new ones can be formed. But state and federal governments do need to kind of step to the plate more on this charging infrastructure type of issue, or even if you're looking beyond electrification, any kind of alternative fuel infrastructure is going to have to be in place to drive mass adoption.
Kent, welcome to the program.
Hello. Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
And what is your question?
Well, I wanted to go back to the geothermal installation at Ball State. The question I have is this. I've been in several homes that have geothermal systems, and all of which had systems that used the groundwater and then dumped it out into a ditch someplace. And that frankly bothered me aesthetically and for the use of groundwater. And I was wondering what impact that Ball State insulation would have on groundwater, and how is it a closed loop, open loop, or what sort of thing is happening there?
Good question. Thank you for calling. Jim, I think that one's probably directed toward you, Jim Lowe of Ball State.
That is a good question, and I apologize early on. I should have pointed out that ours is a vertical closed loop system.
Can you explain what that means? I know Ken understands that, and you do, but I'm guessing that there's probably at least 50% of our audience that wouldn't.
Well, think of it as a closed piping system that the water running through it will always be the same water running through it today, tomorrow, and the next day. That water never leaves that piping system. Its purpose is just to move energy from the ground into the water, from the water to our heat pump chillers, and then back to the ground again. And so you make a good point. There are systems that are open systems that will extract water from the ground or the aquifer, and it does the same thing. It actually, that 55-degree water will allow you to dispense heat or to extract heat, and the typical process is to discharge that water into an open waterway. That is not the type of system we're installing. We're installing 100% closed system, and as such, feel it's even more so environmentally friendly.
Does it cost more to do the closed loop system, or is it?
It
is
does.
Is that part of the resistance to?
Yeah, the closed loop system, because of the fact that it is a closed loop system, you're drilling potentially more holes into the ground. With an open system, Perhaps you might be able to drill a dozen pathways to the water source to gain enough GPM to do your heat exchange. And yes, as such, your upfront cost could be less. But again, there is a potential for damage to the aquifer with such a large system, and then you have to have a potential point to discharge that water.
And is that the reason you had it? Was it 36,000 or
3,600?
3,600 holes,
yes,
to do this project.
Right.
Pat, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
I'm fine, and thank you for accepting this call.
Oh, sure.
I'm not sure if the panel is relevant to this concern I have, based on a documentary I saw about oil extraction from the ground, in which you dig very deeply, pull up whatever sand or dirt of some kind, and then put it through a process in which oil is found or extracted. And so, of course, the sad thing was to see the impact on the local groundwater with their health issues of utilizing that water for drinking and cooking. So are any of the individuals on that panel informed about that?
Well, we will take that question up. Thank you for calling, Pat.
Oh,
Thanks. I think probably if I could reframe the question ever so slightly, it's about the cost. I mean, clearly, in addition to being more expensive to get oil these days, I think what she's alluding to is it's becoming, the environmental costs are becoming much greater. The more effort we have to expend, and the harder we have to go after it. Patrick Flynn, you're nodding your head, so I'm going
to
go with you.
I actually happen to come from an engineering firm in Colorado. I used to work that did oil and gas, and have a little bit of knowledge, sometimes just enough to be dangerous. but I don't know in particular which type of drilling she's talking about. There is some experimental drilling actually happening in western Colorado where there are a lot of environmental concerns, where there's a lot of oil trapped within these sands, and it's a very heavily water intensive process, and that could be the type of project she's talking about. Of course, the big buzzword around a lot of this has been hydrofracking and the issues they've had in Pennsylvania and contamination of groundwater, and it is expensive, but it's also, I think, a process that a lot of people don't necessarily fully understand, and I didn't until I had been out there. And most people are doing all that they can to protect the environment, to protect groundwater. I don't believe that most of these companies' intention is to harm the environment in that negative a way, but there are situations and times where the wrong technology and wrong application is applied to the type of drilling that they're doing and trying to extract the oil or the gas from the ground. And unfortunately, that's what happens. What happens is you get the negative press out of that, whether it's the BP oil spill or the things that are happening out in Pennsylvania. But it is going to be getting more and more expensive, and gas and oil have to be at certain levels for these companies to stay sustainable.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Derek, who says that, not sure if we'd mentioned the Windiana conference downtown yesterday and today. Ed Begley Jr. apparently gave several talks. Yes. And Clean Cities is working on CNG fleets in Indy. Lots of options coming there. Carrie, I think you've got a question that is on point there. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Thank you for joining the program. We've got just a few minutes, so if you could do your question quickly, we would appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. Well, I really just wanted to get some thoughts or your opinions on, since we have this amazing technology to use wind power to generate electricity, and then we have this incredible ability to have hybrid cars, and has anyone ever given any thought into using the electric side of a hybrid car and using the natural wind that's created from your car just moving, and finding a way to use turbines or some kind of wind power to generate that electricity? So technically, I guess you could go infinite amount of miles and have your car continue to be generated by the wind that it's naturally creating.
Carrie, if you are not an engineer, you should be. Thank you. Thank you for the call.
Keep her on the line. I want to get a resume.
All right. Thank you, Carrie. Chris Cowger.
I think it definitely an interesting creative point. In terms of harnessing the wind energy from a moving vehicle, if it's been done, I certainly haven't heard of it. But there's two close proxies that I have, which I think are exactly that. And one is what's called regenerative braking. Right? I'm sure a lot of folks have heard of that, where basically a tremendous amount of energy is released when you're going from 50, 65 miles an hour down the highway and you ultimately brake to a stop. That uses a tremendous amount of energy in the brake pads, the rotors, et cetera. And so there's been a lot of advancement in automotive technology around what's the right way to capture that energy and ultimately feed it back to the battery, so that while you might not be going in an infinitely sustainable loop based on the wind you're creating, you can certainly regeneratively use a lot of the energy that's inherent in just stop-go motion.
Well, and I think in that area, we've seen an explosion. I mean, you think about it, 5 years ago, hybrids seemed like something almost out of a science fiction novel, and now it's almost as if they're every other car on the road these days. Where are we in terms of this technological breakthrough? I'll go with Patrick Flynn.
To her question, I think that there's got to be engineers somewhere working on a lot of these types of issues, because ultimately the higher the miles per gallon or miles per whatever you want to call it, if you don't have to even use gas, if it's all electric, I'm sure there's someone out there. I think that technology has come a very, very, very long way, and I think that has to do with things that NR1 are doing with battery technology, as well as the auto manufacturers seeing a need for higher, more cost-effective solutions and cars that go a longer way without having to use as much gasoline. So you're going to see things like now plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, as well as all-electric vehicles, as well as the traditional hybrids, but they're also going to be in different types of vehicles. They're not just going to be in small cars like the Prius, because a lot of people may not want a small four-door car. They may want a large SUV or a truck or something that's...
Have a hybrid SUV.
The Toyota Highlander hybrid or the Escape, there are some that are mid-size, but it's also goes to the point of the electric vehicles. They're not, the Think car isn't the most spacious car in the world. It's a two-door car that looks like it'd fit through.
It apparently creates Chris some anxiety.
Yeah, I've had the same anxiety. I've had the same anxiety out on I-70 the first time you take it out on the highway. But it's just not, maybe as large of a car or practical of a car for people with larger families. So you have to look at, they're going to take those and scale them up and scale them to sizes that people may want, as well as, the types of cars that people are really looking at.
I've enjoyed talking with all of you, and I feel like this hour has just flown by. I'd like to thank my guests, Patrick Flynn of the Indiana Office of Energy Development. Patrick, it was a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Cowger, president of NR1 Indianapolis. Enjoyed talking with you too, Chris.
You as well, John. Appreciated being here.
Certainly. And Jim Lowe, head of Ball State University's geothermal project, where they're drilling lots of holes in the ground. Jim, good to have you here.
It's been a great day.
We are, and I would like to apologize. There are a lot of questions from listeners that we just ran out of time getting to. We will be talking next week with Police Chief Paul Soselski. I hope you will listen to us. I am John Kroll. I enjoyed spending this time with you. Take care.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Matthew Sosi. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.